become the only candidate banned from running in November's district council election.
And that might lead to more violence this weekend in Hong Kong. This is Wednesday, the 29th of October, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You are part of this program. Find out how you can be part by joining us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, China appears to have made some concessions in its trade war with the United States. A new study claims to have pinpointed the birthplace of modern humans. And one way to sell an expensive car, cover it with diamonds. That's happened. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Hong Kong authorities barred pro-democracy activist Joshua Wong from an election as the city's leader warned Tuesday that months of violent protest have pushed the city to the brink of recession.
On Tuesday, Wong confirmed the ban on the grounds that advocacy for Hong Kong's self-determination violates election law. He called the move political censorship.
Now, I become the only candidate banned from running in November's district council election. The decision to ban me from running office is clearly politically driven. The so-called reasons is judging subjectively on my intention to uphold basic law. But everyone would know that the true reason is my identity, Joshua Wong, is the crime in their mind.
Wong has not been a prominent figure in the last 5 months of sometimes violent protests, which are largely leaderless. However, he has a high profile abroad. Wong went on a tour to the U.S. and Germany this year, lobbying for overseas support for the protests. Beijing has said that it strongly disapproved of his meetings with foreign politicians. Chinese state media has called him a pro-independence leader, a claim he denies. Barring Wong from elections is likely to fuel further discord in Hong Kong. He urged protesters to take to the streets this weekend, which is expected to be filled with violent clashes. Long-running protests have taken a heavy toll on the city's economy.
That was Reuters correspondent Ryan Brooks. In comments likely to further anger protesters, the chief executive of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, said there would be no political solution until the violent protests gripping the semi-autonomous Chinese territory come to an end.
The most effective solution is to tackle the violence head on. For the government to resort to measures that will appease the violent rioters, I don't think that is a solution. And I feel that many of Hong Kong people, yes, they may have some unhappiness and grievances about the government policies, about the government handling of this major crisis. But the time now is really to put in all our efforts to say no to violence in order to have a chance to put an end to this extreme violence that we have seen.
The 23-year-old Wong became known as the young face of Hong Kong's umbrella movement that peacefully occupied streets for 79 days in 2014. He since has been repeatedly arrested and jailed. He's played a smaller role in the current protest, those whose leadership is more diffuse, but China's communist leaders have targeted him in accusing foreign powers of colluding with anti-China separatists to foment unrest. Wong posted on his Twitter account a copy of a letter ruling invalid his nomination as a candidate in the November 24th local district council elections. The government confirmed Wong's disqualification without identifying him. The letter said Wong's embrace of the concept of self-determination includes Hong Kong's independence, which violates a requirement to promise to uphold its constitution. Wong denied that, saying his answers to the officer's questions were twisted as part of a mind-reading game. We continue. China Tuesday promised more improvements in conditions for foreign companies, including an end to officials pressing them to hand over technology, a key irritant in its tariff war with Washington. The announcement adds to a drumbeat of market-opening promises by the communist government, which is trying to make China's cooling state-dominated economy more productive. Beijing also will ease restrictions on foreign competitors in some newly opened finance businesses, according to the Commerce Ministry. Complaints about Beijing's technology ambitions helped to spark its tariff war with President Donald Trump. Trade negotiators are working out details of an October 11th agreement under which President Trump delayed a planned tariff hike on Chinese imports. Trump said Beijing agreed to buy more American farm goods in exchange, though China has yet to confirm details of that commitment. China's direct investment in the United States has slowed to a trickle, dropping 80% from 2016 to 2018, according to New York-based research provider Rhodium Group. Among the hardest hit sectors are real estate and hospitality, with Chinese investors no longer scrambling to buy prime properties in cities like New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports on what's behind this downward trend and how it's impacting one American city in particular.
The Los Angeles skyline can be seen from Stephen Chung's office, but something is missing, and what he is not seeing worries him.
The skylines are no longer filled with cranes or supplied by Chinese investments coming over here. What we're worried about are the construction that's already here that cannot be finished because of the financing situation.
Chung says one example of this is the billion-dollar Oceanwide Plaza, located in a prized location near the Los Angeles Convention Center and the complex where the Lakers and Clippers play basketball. Work stalled in January for this condo, hotel, and retail space, and Chung has seen very little activity since then.
In terms of people moving to that location and actually the retail activity that's going to be there, that's revenue that we will not be getting as soon as we hope.
The standstill at Oceanwide Plaza is but one sign of a sharp drop in capital flowing from China at a time of heightened tensions between the two superpowers. Overall direct foreign investment between China and the U.S. peaked in 2016 to a record $60 billion, then dropped drastically, according to the Rhodium Group. One reason is a change in China's monetary policy, says Los Angeles-based land use lawyer Dale Goldsmith.
There were the currency controls out of China where a lot of companies were parking money. I think it was probably to get money out of China and into a safe investment. And at the end of the day, the Chinese cracked down on that.
Another reason is increased vigilance by a federal watchdog organization, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. The Rhodium Group estimates the committee's scrutiny has led Chinese investors to abandon more than $2.5 billion in U.S. deals. A relatively strong U.S. economy is another factor.
The dollar has been very strong, making investment a lot less attractive for the Chinese in the States. On top of it, you'd have skyrocketing construction costs.
To top it all off, a trade war persists between the U.S. and China, sowing uncertainty in an already challenging investment climate.
Part of the reason why we're seeing really not any new projects coming from China is because of the China trade war, not knowing the future. And as the tensions escalating, I think a lot of the Chinese companies are wary in terms of whether they should enter the U.S. market.
The trade war is creating another trend. To avoid high tariffs, international companies are moving manufacturing out of China and into Southeast Asian countries. In some countries, it's creating new wealth. Others are trying to increase their direct foreign investment to offset the trade war's negative effects in their own countries.
Specifically, Vietnam and Indonesia. Over the past few years, they've been a lot more active seeking for business opportunities.
So long as economic tensions remain high between Washington and Beijing, Los Angeles and other U.S. cities will have to look elsewhere for investment capital. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
An Australian-led study has claimed to have pinpointed the birthplace of modern humans to a region south of the Zambezi River in southern Africa. Scientists have used DNA as well as climate and geological data to track our evolution back 200,000 years to what is now part of Botswana, Namibia, and Zimbabwe. However, other experts believe there are flaws in the research, which is published in the journal Nature. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Scientists in Australia believe they've rewritten human history. They say our ancestral homeland was near a giant lake in southern Africa. Researchers have traced an ancient family tree using about 1,200 samples of mitochondrial DNA, which are passed from a mother to her child. The research team says this has allowed them to map out the oldest known maternal line of humans alive today. By combining genetics with geology and climate computer model simulations, the researchers have created an impression of what the African continent might have been like 200,000 years ago. Professor Vanessa Hayes is at Australia's Garvan Institute of Medical Research.
We could trace with our DNA back to this region called Makhali Makhali. But then when we overlaid the geographic data plus the climate data, it pinpointed that this must have been the region because it was like an oasis in this huge desert, which allowed anatomically modern humans to not only survive, but to thrive.
After staying there for 70,000 years, people began to move out when a changing climate created fertile green corridors, paving the way for future migrations away from Africa. However, other experts doubt that the human story can be reconstructed from this type of genetic analysis alone. Previous studies which have analysed fossils have suggested our origins lie in eastern Africa. There is the possibility that modern humans evolved at similar times in different places before interbreeding. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In Santa Fe, New Mexico, a unique college has been immersing students in Native American contemporary arts and culture for more than 55 years. This one-of-a-kind school draws both Native and non-Native Americans from across the country who wish to explore their artistic abilities while learning more about the diverse range of Native cultures in their homeland. VOA's Julie Tabo takes us on a tour.
The Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico, stands out against the stunning desert landscape of the American Southwest. Here, on this sprawling 56-hectare campus, about 500 students are immersed in contemporary Native American arts and culture. Institute President Robert Martin, who is Cherokee, says members of about 100 tribes on average attend the school.
That's a lot of diversity, and of course we also have non-Native students as well. We're open to everybody, but our mission will always reflect that Indigenous or Native perspective. I think that's an important aspect of what we have here is a sense of community, almost a sense of family.
Daniel Yazin Atonaba feels that connection.
Growing up on the reservation, I was entirely isolated. I was surrounded by, you know, other Natives of the similar tribes. And my whole perspective of the world was just Navajo. But when I've came here, I've learned other perspectives of Yaqui, Tohono O'odham, Pueblos.
My work is paying homage to the people who raised me.
Dolores Scarlett Cortez is exploring her roots through printmaking and photography.
Growing up, I felt like I was really missing that kind of side of me because my parents never talked about it. What I'm hoping to do is go back to my community to document the people back home that I really care for.
That feeling of giving back to the community is not unusual among the students, says Martin.
If you ask the average college student why they're going to college, what they're going to do with their degree, they'll say, I want a job. You ask our students and they'll say, I want to be of service to my family and my community. And so that makes our students different.
It's called shelter.
Student Daniel Forrest appreciates that unique perspective.
I'm learning how to walk differently, really pay attention, because Western culture tends to be a little conquistador, a little aggressive, and you just take that with you wherever you go in the world. It sort of suits you for the most part. That doesn't work here. So I'm learning to just recalibrate everything.
I always wanted to bring something back to my culture.
Many of the school's graduates return to teach there years later. Anthony Dieter, who graduated 25 years ago, teaches a new concept in filmmaking, a digital dome where viewers watch moving images on a spherical screen rather than a flat one. The new technology is very fitting, given his native background.
We're indigenous cultures, and we are not linear. We're spherical. We're round. And I'm going, so here, all of a sudden, here's a media that's totally immersive for us to tell our stories actually in the round.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Santa Fe, New Mexico.
I'm Ira Mellon in Washington. Enjoy your day.